Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife. We're here with Dr. Frank Veith. He's a professor of surgery at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and in New York University Medical Center in New York. He also occupies the William J. von Liebig Chair in Vascular Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation. Dr. Veith has been the past chairman of the American Board of Vascular Surgery and served as the 50th president of the Society for Vascular Surgery. Dr. Veith has authored and co-authored more than 1,000 original articles and chapters in medical journals. Thank you, Dr. Veith, for joining us on Behind the Knife.
When I was doing some research for this interview, I came across your presidential address to the Society of Vascular Surgery, and I believe it was 1996, and it was pretty eye-opening, this address, and we're going to put it on our website for all of our listeners to be able to read it after they listen to this interview. But it was titled Charles Darwin and Vascular Surgery. And in this interview, and remind you, this for our listeners, this is 1996, you predicted that the survival of vascular surgery depended on adapting to endovascular techniques. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you had that insight at that point in time, and if you have any other thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, like so many things, that address, which turned out to be in some ways on target, was in some quarters met with skepticism, hostility, and general disdain. And what I was trying to do at that time was give vascular surgery some guidance toward its future, because I felt strongly that the world was changing in the sense that endovascular techniques were going to replace a lot of what we were doing as open vascular surgeons. And I got the idea, which was really an epiphany, when we did the first endovascular aneurysm repair together with Juan Perotti and some of my partners, among them Mike Marin, who's now at Mount Sinai. We had the good fortune and put in a great deal of effort and did the first EVAR outside of Argentina in the U.S. We did that in 1992, and it worked remarkably well. And then we began a program of endovascular grafting where we made the grafts ourselves and used them on a variety of vascular lesions, aneurysms, occlusive lesions, traumatic lesions, and they, you know, they were surprisingly good. They worked well in very difficult circumstances. And so I had the idea that that should be the topic of my presidential addresses to both the Eastern Vascular and the Society for Vascular Surgery, and with the goal of telling vascular surgeons that if they did not embrace endovascular techniques, which were fairly primitive at the time compared to now, that they were going to be out of a job. And I use the Darwin analogy because survival of the fittest. There's, you know, the fit species, the one that's best adapted to its environment, will be the one that survives and ultimately will replace other less fit and less well adapted species. And so, in that address, there were three things that I felt that vascular surgery had to do. One was embrace and learn endovascular techniques and become endocompetent. And I said, if you don't do that, you're going to become extinct, following the Darwin analogy. And then the other thing that was in that address was that I thought we should partner up with interventional specialists, which we had sort of done when we did our first cases. I mean, they were teaching us the catheter guide wire techniques that we really didn't know a lot about, and we were willing to teach them the open vascular surgery techniques and a little bit about vascular disease, which they didn't know too well. And so we had the idea of promoting vascular centers, and that never worked very well for a variety of reasons, mostly the fallibility of human nature, not wanting to share and so forth. So that never worked very well, at least in the United States. There are a couple of exceptions in other countries. And we also had the idea that vascular surgery was going to change and become a separate species and leave the common ancestor of general surgery, much as all the other surgical specialties had. And if the American Board of Surgery wasn't willing to give us some degree of independence, I advocated that we had to have an independent board and residency review committee in order to morph into this new species of separate vascular surgeon specialist. And that was a fight that I was engaged in for a long time and actually led for a number of years along with Jim Stanley. And we had a big battle with the American Board of Surgery and the American Board of Medical Specialties, and we lost that battle for a variety of what I think were terrible reasons. And so that vascular surgery to this day remains a subordinate specialty, although it has advanced in some regards due to that effort, it remains a separate subordinate specialty within general surgery. And we can talk more about this later, but I think that failure to gain independence is still very bad, not only for us as vascular surgeons, but for our patients. And we can talk about why, you know, later on. But anyhow, the idea of embracing endovascular techniques was one that was at first repudiated by all the senior vascular leaders, but then gradually, and I guess I was involved and responsible for some of this, it was gradually over the next 5 to 7 years was embraced by vascular surgery, and now is fully embraced by vascular surgery. And I guess in some ways we've morphed, but the other two recommendations in that address didn't pan out. The one thing I estimated in that address and the one in 1994 to the Eastern, that 40 to 70% of open vascular operations would be ultimately transformed into endovascular procedures, and some of the ones that were left would be improved or simplified by using the endovascular techniques with a fluoroscope and catheters and guide wires that we were learning how to do. And even though I was ridiculed for making that ridiculous estimate, it turns out that I was probably wrong, not on the high side, which everybody said, but on the low side, because these days I think 80 to 95% of open vascular operations that were being done in the 80s and 90s will be replaced by some form of endovascular procedure. Maybe more, I don't know.
Huh. Yeah, that is, you couldn't have been more on point with the endovascular. If you were to give that speech today at the SVS in, say, 2016, could you summarize a few of your points that you'd give to the society this year?
Well, I'm probably going to do that in June because I've been asked to give a talk at the SVS on just that topic, where I see us going in the next 10, 15 years. First of all, I was wrong. I think more procedures that I thought would be done endovascularly at that time, I think probably I was wrong on the low side, not the high side, as everyone said. I think now, and of course I advocated vascular surgeons getting become competent to do the endovascular stuff, and they've done that, reluctantly at first, but now very definitely. Now the big problem is getting young vascular surgeons trained to do open procedures. And I'm not sure I have an answer for that. I mean, these days, I mean, one of my other areas of interest was lower extremity bypasses, and we were pretty good at it. And our fellows would do 100 difficult leg cases in a year, and they became pretty good at it. Now, since most of the cases are done endovascularly, open vascular bypasses in the lower extremity is a lost art. And the same is true with difficult aneurysms. So the worry is for young training vascular surgeons to get enough open experience, not endo experience, which is our worry then. So that would be one area that I would make different. I think probably there'll be specialized centers which are devoted to doing good lower extremity bypasses and good open aneurysm operations, because some patients will always require that. And there won't be many guys around in the next 10 or 15 years who can do those operations and do them well. So that would be one area of change. The other thing I think is that, and this was sort of partly expressed in that Darwin article or Darwin talk, I was worried about the dabblers in treatment of vascular disease, even then. The guys who say they're a cardiac surgeon and they add a couple of vascular cases on at the end, do them poorly. That was going on back in the 90s. I was worried about the interventionalists perhaps doing, and there's some really wonderful interventional cardiologists and interventional radiologists who have contributed magnificently to the field, but there are also some dabblers, particularly in cardiology, who mostly take care of hearts, but at the end of the day, they tack on a carotid stent or a leg case, probably not doing it very well and probably doing patients who are best treated conservatively. So I think the concern about other specialties intruding on our field, which they consider to be their field as well, and in some ways they're justified, but intruding and doing it poorly, I think that's a major worry. And today it's probably in the 90s it was the interventional radiologist a little more than the cardiologists were just coming onto the scene, but now the cardiologists are trying to take over the vascular field, the non-cardiac vascular field, totally. I mean, they're doing EVARs and TVARs and certainly a lot of lower extremity work, as well as carotids. And some of it they do well, but a lot of it is not done well. And a lot of it is on patients who are probably best treated conservatively, in my opinion. So that's another area of concern, and it's certainly a concern for our specialty. And the other thing is, I think we need to be a separate defined specialty with an independent board of vascular surgery and a residency review committee in vascular surgery, just like neurosurgery, GYN, orthopedics, general surgery, et cetera. But that's a fight we tried very hard. I personally tried very hard to win, and we lost. And, you know, the reasons for that we can discuss, but they weren't good. And So I think vascular surgery is still a somewhat endangered species or subspecies right now. We're not a full species yet, although we've made a little progress in that regard. You know, we have 0 and 5 trainees who are trained under the purview of a vascular surgeon. But I think we ought to have, we ought to be a separate recognized specialty, just like other specialties which have defined areas of interest. And I think that probably, it's happened in every other country, virtually every other country in the world. It has not happened in the United States, and in my opinion, probably won't happen because of the bad defeat that we were handed back in 2006 and 2007.
Well, Dr. Veith, I think it's super interesting that, you know, the shift from the centers of, you know, endovascular surgery, the centers that specifically do this, and now there might be in the future centers that specialize only in open procedures. I think that's really interesting. I know.
Well, I think that certainly is what I would want if I were a patient. I mean, I don't want a dabbler, even if he's a vascular surgeon, doing my distal bypass when he does maybe one a year and has done maybe 10 in his career. I want to go to some guy that's done over 100, maybe more. And clearly, that's true with hip operations, that's true with brain tumors, that's true with everything. That the super specialist is the one who will do the best job.
Yeah, I know that's
The jack of all trades is master of none.
It's definitely a concern in the resident world, too. As Kevin and I both were residents, vascular surgery is certainly the endovascular focus nowadays, and we don't get the open procedures like I'm sure, residents 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that you touched on was your relationship with vascular surgery and IR and cardiology. How do you foresee these services should interact with each other in the future?
Well, going back to Darwin, it's still a scrum fight because those three specialties, and throw in cardiac surgery too, and maybe even nephrology, everybody thinks they own vascular disease patients. And in my opinion, interventional radiologists were the ones that I would normally partner up with. And they've been, there was a lot of political issues and so forth, but interventional radiology has sort of been forced out of vascular treatment because of vascular surgeons and cardiologists largely controlling the patients. So I think interventional radiologists are good guys, and I think they should still be involved in vascular disease, and they can do procedures in the vascular arena that I think we can't do as well. I mean, some of the uterine embolization, some of the tumor embolization, I think they do that really very well. And their problem is that they are generally, there are a couple of exceptions, but they're generally, they don't have practices. They're a referral service. They're proceduralists. And they therefore have suffered, the interventional radiologists have suffered in this fight for food and space. And I think to some extent that's not right. The bad guys in the mix are the cardiologists, because, and I say bad in quotes, I don't think they're bad guys. I think they're bad actors in the sense that there's so many of them, and they all think they can do everything. And if you look at the definition in the dictionary, cardiology, it refers to especially it deals with the heart, and that's what they are very competent with. But they also believe that they can use these techniques to treat every vessel in the body. I jokingly say they can treat any hollow viscous, so next they'll be stenting prostates. But they haven't done that yet. But they really, as a specialty, have tried to take over the treatment of vascular disease in many communities, and as a result, I think in some communities, the patients have suffered because some of these guys are doing procedures that are best not done. patients are better treated medically. And that there was an article in the Times last year about this, that some interventional cardiologist was making $14 million a year putting stents and SFAs in asymptomatic patients or minimally symptomatic patients. And I think that's bad. On the other hand, there's some really brilliant interventional cardiologists that do things in the periphery that, you know, are groundbreaking, that we have to be the followers on. And this is particularly true in Europe and Germany and Italy. Some of these guys are really masters, and they deserve to be in the field. It's the dabblers that bother me and I think are bad for patient care.
Sir, we know that... One thing we didn't mention in the introduction is that you host one of the premier vascular surgery symposiums in the world that has international attendance of the most prominent vascular surgeons. The one question I had, though, is do you allow cardiologists at the VEITH symposium?
Oh, we welcome cardiologists. In fact, you know, I'd say a third of our faculty, or maybe it's a quarter, are interventional radiologists, cardiologists, angiologists. I would love to get more practicing American interventional cardiologists to attend our meeting, but they don't because it's viewed as a vascular surgery meeting. But it's really not. It's definitely a vascular specialist meeting, and some of the best information that can be gleaned from that meeting comes from interventional cardiologists and interventional radiologists and even other vascular specialists. And we also feature non-procedural folks, neurologists, vascular medicine people, those that are expert in treating vascular disease medically, which is the right treatment for most vascular lesions, although arguably some vascular surgeons and some cardiologists wouldn't agree with that. They want to put a stent in everything. And we think that's not right. And so we feature everybody outside of the vascular surgery as well if they have a lot to contribute. And some cardiac surgeons, you know, they have a lot to contribute too.
Dr. Veith, where do you see the future of training programs for vascular surgery? Were there always be fellowships available for general surgeons, or will it be, you know, a direct residency placement?
Part of that's a political question. I happen to believe, and it was really in our American Board of Vascular Surgery application, we were the ones who proposed the two tracks, the 0 and 5 and the 5 and 2, which are going, and the booby prize we got for being defeated in gaining an independent board was a did accept the 0 and 5 as one track for vascular trainees. You know, not everybody can make up their mind that they want to go into vascular surgery right out of medical school. And so that I think there's still a role for the 5 and 2 trainee, and our application had that, as well as the fully vascular trainee. The problem is that vascular is such a large field now that you probably need to spend all your time doing vascular and not really very much time doing gallbladders and breast biopsies and thyroidectomies, although it doesn't hurt to have all that surgical experience. But some of it's political. I don't know where it's going to go. I think if we had an independent board now, things have changed. It used to be that general surgeons were trying to do vascular surgery, I've just got to get rid of this phone call.
Yep,
general surgeons were trying to do all vascular surgery, and that, of course, led to some very bad results, and we documented that in our application. I think there's less of that now. Most general surgeons aren't trying to do vascular surgery, or they only do the very minor stuff. So that problem has sort of gone away, but the place where we suffer from not having our own independent board is that we aren't regarded as co-equals with general surgery and cardiac surgery and neurosurgery in assigning the resources that are necessary for us as a specialty to thrive. Because in most institutions, we're subordinate either to cardiac surgery or general surgery, so we don't have a seat at the table where these resource distributing decisions are made. I think that's the main reason that we should have an independent board and independent department for vascular surgery, but it won't happen under the present system, at least in the United States.
Sir, correct me if I was wrong, but when I was reading up about some of your history, is it true that you were actually trained in lung transplant prior to deciding that you wanted to go into vascular surgery?
No, I didn't train in it. That was my area of research interest for probably 10 or 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And, I trained, I had some transplant experience in my residency, really very little vascular experience. And so for a while I was doing transplants, and lung transplants were an unsolved problem. And so we addressed that and solved many of the problems. And then we did some of the first clinical lungs and so forth, and was in the pre-cyclosporin era mostly. And it's hard to make a living doing lung transplants, and because there weren't that many of them then. And so my other interest was always vascular surgery.
Great. Well, sir, now we're going to move into the part of our conversation that we call the dissection of the day. And this is where we talk to our experts about a specific topic. And along with endovascular overall, one field that you have helped advance in vascular surgery has been the treatment of ruptured AAAs with endovascular stents. I was wondering if you could give us sort of the preoperative considerations, the prep of the patient, and just kind of briefly walk us through this procedure for our listeners out there.
Okay, well, try to be brief. The open surgical treatment of ruptured aneurysms was always an area of great interest to me, and we were pretty good at it, and we still had a 50% plus mortality. And when we started doing EVARs, it was obvious that this was a way that I thought we could reduce the morbidity and mortality of ruptured aneurysms. And so we did the first EVAR for a ruptured aneurysm, I guess back in 1994. Some other people were doing it about the same time, but we actually did the first one. And it became obvious that patients who were otherwise inoperable or couldn't possibly survive an open operation would survive an endovascular repair. So we popularized it, talked about it, wrote about it, and then we started to speculate that EVAR was the best way to treat all aneurysms, not just the ones that were impossible to operate on and open. And we got great results, and some other people started to get great results. And interestingly enough, it's still controversial. And there are three recent randomized trials comparing open and endo repair for ruptured AAAs, and interestingly, they showed no benefit. But they didn't use all the tips and tricks that we and others have developed for doing it right. So EVAR is hard enough on elective aneurysms. It's much more tricky and difficult on ruptured aneurysms because you don't have your team there, they're emergency, they occur at night. So there's several points that we have come up with. We call them strategies, technical tips, and adjuncts that enable one to treat a ruptured aneurysm with an EVAR and get good results. And the three randomized studies really didn't use in a systematic or optimal way these various adjuncts which we've come up with. And one of the things that we believe very strongly in, although it's still controversial, is not to transfuse or resuscitate the ruptured aneurysm patient. And that many of them will stop bleeding long enough to accomplish insertion of an EVAR. So no transfusion, no resuscitation. Our rule is as long as the patient is talking and moving, he's adequately resuscitated, whatever his blood pressure is, his or her. So that's one, we call it hypotensive hemostasis. Other people call it permissive hypotension, but bottom line, no resuscitation till the hole in the aneurysm is sealed. So that's one technical trick. A second one is if the patient collapses and either has a cardiac arrest or then we use a supraceliac aortic balloon, usually introduced through the femoral artery, and it's not simple. There's a lot of tips and tricks to do it right, and sometimes you have to use two balloons or maybe three balloons. And there's an article in the JVS, I think it's 2014, by Berland and myself, that goes through the steps, how to use the supraceliac aortic balloon effectively in the ruptured aneurysm setting. But as I say, it's not simple, because you've got the balloon and the sheath that holds it going up one side of the patient, one femoral artery, and you got the endograft going up the other side, and, you know, they can get in each other's way. So there's some tips and tricks as to how to do that effectively, and it's very important. And balloons should not be used unless the patient collapses, because there's some morbidity and complications of using the balloon. And, of course, it has to be inserted under fluoroscopic control and not overinflated or ruptured the aorta, stuff like that. So there are a lot of tips and tricks for using the balloon right. And then there's another very important adjunct, which is diagnosing and treating abdominal compartment syndrome. Because these patients bleed a lot, and they get, particularly if they're over-resuscitated, the bowels get edematous, and they get abdominal compartment syndrome, and there's a whole system for diagnosing it by measuring the bladder pressure. There's several articles on this, and then treating it by opening the abdomen or in some way decompressing it to allow the patient to have recovery of their breathing and their renal function, et cetera. So the whole idea of diagnosing and treating abdominal compartment syndrome well is a third trick. And there are a lot of other little tricks, you know, making an early diagnosis, getting an early CAT scan with contrast in the emergency room or close to the emergency room. In the early days, we couldn't do that because of logistics. And so we made our diagnoses and anatomical assessment from an angiogram. But I think now most people can get a CAT scan pretty quickly with contrast. And they can decide whether they can do it endo or need to do it open. And I guess the fourth or fifth item is that you should use EVAR on the worst patients, the ones that are in shock and everything else. I mean, if you just do the contained aneurysms, EVAR, you're going to get good results with open repair. And the differential benefit is saving the very sick, shocky, bad-risk patient, which you can sometimes do with EVAR, which you can't do with open repair. And that's one of the reasons the three randomized trials largely excluded those patients, and therefore they didn't show the benefit of EVAR. And I guess the next thing would be to use chimney and periscope grafts, mostly chimneys, to deal with bad neck aneurysms. And Mario Lachat, who I worked with in the group in Zurich, and Orbo, Sweden, Thomas Larzon, have published papers saying they can treat all ruptured aneurysms, not just a small percentage or 50%. They can treat them all by EVAR by using chimney grafts and other adjuncts. That may be not possible in many institutions, but we think 60, 70, maybe even 80% of ruptured aneurysms can be treated endovascularly if one uses liberal criteria. And I think, as I say, the greatest benefit occurs in the patients that are the sickest. Basically, those are the things that I think are important. And I guess the final thing would be to have a team to prepare, to have the instruments or catheters, guide wires, balloons, sheaths, etc., that one needs to do the procedure, have them in a kit so that if it happens at night or when the nurses don't know where they are, the surgeons or others doing these procedures know how to do them and know how to find the equipment. And having a committed group, I think that all adds to the benefit of using EVAR and makes it possible. You can't do it as an amateurish business. You've got to really put some energy and effort into it, or it's going to fail. You're going to have bad results. So that about summarizes the. I mean, there are a bunch of articles where we've described all this. If anybody's interested in it.
Yeah, and we will put links to that on the podcast here so people can check those out along with your address.
The main article, we reviewed the world experience as of 2009 or 10, and there's an article in Annals of Surgery on the collected world experience in its Annals of Surgery 2009. I'm the first author. And that paper sort of summarizes a lot of the things I said, although... There's another article, the first author is Dieter Meyer, M-A-Y-E-R. It's also in Annals of Surgery in 2012 that talks about the experience where they could do 100% over a two-year period of EVARs. 100% of ruptured aneurysms could be treated by EVAR. And the results were remarkably good, and they had a very low turndown rate. What happens is that patients who are not suitable for open repair, they just get left to die. And many, and even in the average is 20-30% of patients are treated what they call it expectantly or palliatively. Well, that's nonsense. They're just allowed to die. And I think in some places in Britain and Europe, it's up to 50% are just not treated. And those patients, in this article by Meyer and his colleagues in Thomas Lauzon, the two places, they were able to treat 96% of the aneurysms that showed up at the hospital. 4%, I guess, died before they could treat them. But the exclusion rate, the turndown rate, so-called, is very low, 4%. And they still had an overall mortality that was 24%, which is pretty damn good.
Yeah, that is.
So I think those articles are important. And I think Dieter Meyer and Mario Lachat have articles on how to treat compartment syndrome. There's a whole big thing on that. It's not simple. You leave the abdomen open, then how do you get it closed, et cetera, et cetera. So all these things are a little complicated, but that's what produces the good results with EVAR.
Great. One of the few ruptured aneurysms that I've been involved with was actually on my last call a week ago. And a patient came in, old man. He was chronic kidney disease stage 4 at baseline. He had a creatinine of like 3.5 at his nephrology visit earlier that month. And he came in with a creatinine of 4.5 to the ER. He was hypotensive, had back pain, kind of classic symptoms. The question that we had was whether to use contrast in the CT scanner and whether to use contrast. The normal loads of contrast while doing placing the EVAR in angiographically.
Well, listen, you've described a patient that has a very high mortality. I don't know how old he was, but Ben Starnes and Manny Mater and I are writing a textbook on ruptured aneurysms, you know, monograph. And one of the chapters, we got somebody to write, when is it hopeless?
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I have a... attitude, I guess you'd call it, where I don't think anything is hopeless. You know, the badly gangrenous foot, the ruptured aneurysm that's arrested a couple of times. I guess if the patient's 100 years old, and as you described, that patient's probably not worth treating, but you can't really tell. I mean, patients... This one chapter, the fellow who wrote it says if the patient is arrested... That makes it hopeless or almost hopeless. I've had several patients that have rested a couple of times, and we saved them. And, you know, they walk in with a suit and tie in a couple of months and and alive. And that's before EVAR. So I think that most patients who have a ruptured aneurysm deserve a shot at being treated. Now, you get into the cost and utilization of resources, that's a whole other story, but it's very hard to know when an aneurysm patient, a ruptured aneurysm patient, is such a bad risk that he can't be saved, or she, he or she can't be saved. And that's with endo and without. And just like most gangrenous feet can be saved, no matter if they're extensive and a bad anatomy and all the rest. And you just don't know without trying. So that, I know that probably goes against the Affordable Care Act, but I think most patients should be intervened on. Now, it's unquestionable if somebody's in profound shock, especially if they're old and they have a high creatinine, they're bad risk. They're a high chance of dying, whatever you do. Could you use contrast? I think you have to. I mean, you've got to, if you're going to fix them, you got to fix them. And if they, you know, you damage their kidneys enough that they have to be dialyzed, that's part of the game. Now, it's going to be expensive and all the rest, but most of the time, you cannot predict which patient will not make it. Although, statistically, the things you mentioned are creatinine of 4 is terrible. Hypotension, even where did the patient arrest?
The patient did not arrest. No, he was actually sitting up talking to us.
So he got through the procedure.
Yeah, he's still in the ICU, but he's doing relatively well.
So I mean, that you confirm what I said.
Yeah.
And I think you probably should use contrast.
And he is on dialysis now.
He's on dialysis?
Well, now he is, yeah. That was the one consequence. But
is he putting out any urine?
He's oliguric, so...
But he's putting out some urine.
Some urine, so...
Yeah, well, he'll probably recover. But the bottom line is, of course, these are high-risk patients. But, I mean, that's the name of the game. And if I'm an old person and I have an acute illness like this, I'd like to be given a chance to survive.
Definitely.
Well, that concludes our dissection.
It might be very expensive, and it's you know, it uses a lot of resources, but you know, of the dilemmas we face.
Well, thank you, Dr. Veith, for that the great rundown. That concludes our dissection of the day. At this time, we move into our final five. This is where we get to know our interviewees and our experts a little better for the listeners who are out there who haven't met you yet. So we have five questions we want to ask you, and we're just going to rattle them off. So the first question is, what music is on your iPod in the OR and when the resident is not in charge of it, obviously?
I have no music in the OR.
No music?
Unfortunately. I mean, sometimes the anesthesiologist would put it on. I have nothing on my iPad. I don't own an iPad.
How about an iPhone?
I own a BlackBerry.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I think I'm going to have to get an iPhone. My wife has an iPhone. It's got a lot of features. But I like my BlackBerry because that's what I'm talking on, and that's how I get my emails.
Great. Number two, what hobbies, talents, or interests do you have outside of the operating room?
I guess the best, we like animals, game watching, traveling. But I was a pretty good skier and a windsurfer.
Oh, wow.
And I have to say I'm not doing them as often or as vigorously as I did, but those are the two biggies, skiing and windsurfing.
All right. Question number three, what is a favorite trip or vacation that you've recently taken?
The skiing and the windsurfing were great trips, and mm-hmm. the animal watching, Africa and stuff like that, but I haven't done it recently.
Number four, if you had not gone into medicine, what would your occupation be?
A fighter pilot.
You're the second person to say that, actually.
I'd probably be dead. You know, I have the analogy that vascular surgeons come in two types. The arterial surgeon, who doesn't get paid very much now, is the fighter pilot. The venous surgeon is the commercial pilot.
All right, and our fifth and final question: if you can go back in time and see yourself on that first day of internship, what advice would you give yourself?
To me, I'd probably do everything the same. I mean, I've had some big disappointments and big failures, but I'd say the big one is not helping vascular surgery become an independent specialty, because I think that's a big need. And I didn't have no concept of that when I was an intern.
Great.
I wouldn't do much differently.
Well, Dr. Veith, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us on Behind the Knife, and I'm sure all of our listeners out there, both general surgeons and vascular surgeons alike, will really appreciate this interview. Do you have anything that you didn't get out that you're hoping to talk about today?
Well, I guess the other thing is that, you know, as you go on in your career, relationships become more and more important, and you can't do everything by yourself. You have to be either build a team or be part of a team, certainly in vascular surgery. Very hard to do it as a solo person and do it well. And so building relationships and getting in with a group of people that are similarly oriented to oneself, I think, is key. And once you're a leader, your job is to make the people under you successful, not to make yourself successful. That's a lesson a lot of people haven't learned.
Yeah, that's great advice, sir. Thank you for that. All right, Dr. Veith, thanks again for joining us, and we hope to have you back again in the future.
It'd be great. Okay, thank you.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.